Today I'm going to talk about predicting individual behavior. In 1954, when Sigmund Freud was at the height of his influence, and social scientists were just getting acquainted with the newfangled statistical tools developed in agricultural and genetic research, the psychologist Paul Meehl published a slim book entitled Clinical versus Statistical Prediction. Despite its sleepy title, the book became one of the most controversial works in psychology in the latter half of the 20th century. It started with a simple question. How should we predict how a person is going to behave? Should we use objective facts concerning his life history, his scores on psychometric tests, behavior ratings, or checklists, and combine them in a quantitative statistical model to classify them into a category of outcome? Or should we use qualitative interviews, professional experience, and intuition to make a prediction? The first option Meehl called statistical or actuarial, and the second, clinical prediction. Meehl proceeded to assert that statistical predictions are not just useful helpers of clinicians. He argued that clinical predictions tend to be inferior to statistical ones and should be replaced by them. The following 50 years produced a huge amount of evidence, both experimental and quasi-experimental, in and outside psychology addressing this issue. Some of the most insulting results to clinical experts from Meehl and his students were ones that showed that even when the actuarial model was not optimized, just had the list of obvious predictors with the correct sign assigning equal weight to each factor, statistics still beat experts, and the model won even when the clinician had access to equal or greater amount of information. A meta-analysis in 2000 of 136 studies looking at prediction of a wide variety of outcomes, including academic performance, medical events, psychiatric symptoms, job performance and turnover, business success, criminal recidivism, marital satisfaction, coupon redemption, and suicide, just to name a few, all set up as a prediction competition between statistical models and clinical experts, found that only 6% of the studies showed the experts winning. For the rest, statistical models won hands down, or did at least as well as humans. These findings are consistent with Tetlock's study on political predictions I discussed last time. In 2002, an article in the Philosophy of Science with the not-so-subtle title, 50 Years of Successful Predictive Modeling Should Be Enough, insisted that it is time for those believing in human clinical judgment to concede defeat. Statistical predictions are more accurate and they are more reliable, as algorithms don't have bad days and don't get distracted. They are not vulnerable to cognitive fallacies and limitations, the very flaws that psychologists intent on dethroning rational choice theory so deftly reveal. And finally, if an expert can articulate what he knows that the model doesn't, one can easily improve on the model by adding that variable to it as a predictor. Meehl and the legion of his supporters do not claim that actuarial models are good, just that they are better than human predictions, which they admit is not a high bar. Meehl and his followers grew up on the deductive hypothesis testing methodology of social statistics. They learned ANOVA, regression, factor analysis, and the like, where some set of carefully chosen input variables predicted some outcome, each acquiring some weight in the process, showing its importance and direction. These models then could be translated into a narrative, usually by some causal story. Machine learning algorithms are one step further from experts. They find the best fitting algorithm by splitting the sample into two, taking all available inputs. The algorithm finds the best parameters on one part and tests them on the other. In this process, while predictions improve, the meaning of the model disappears. In other words, one cannot translate the results into a story of why. There is no causation, only correlations. If Salganik's challenge, I talked about in the first talk, if in the challenge the machine finds that the best predictor of GPA at age 15 is the product of the logarithm of the child's height and the number of children in her household, so be it. If current statistical models are already proving human judgment obsolete in predictions, the more powerful methods of machine learning should bury clinicians 6 foot under. If all that is true, we would expect that when stakes of predicting are higher, people would choose actuarial models over human judgment. Take three situations where we have to make individual predictions. Credit, where lenders have to predict the future of their loan. Colleges, that have to predict who will do well and therefore should be admitted. And parole officers, who must decide which convict will lead a crime-free life once they are let out early. In each case, one, lender, school, prisons, must make an individual prediction and make an important decision that will affect that individual. So then, why is it that when purchase credit or credit card limit of a few thousand dollars is granted, we see algorithms deployed to make the decision? But when a large corporation wants a 10,000 times larger loan, banks decide by a committee after careful considerations, discussion, and deliberation, and not by a machine. And why is it that we fall back on simple actuarial algorithms when it comes to admitting college students? We take their high school or exit exam grade, we add them together by some formula, depending on the country you may add or subtract points for certain factors, and arrive at an admission score. And as we will see, even these simple algorithms are actually under attack. But when it comes to admitting a doctoral student, and even more so, when hiring a colleague, we are unlikely to leave the decision to some mechanical device that counts publications, weights journals, assigns points for awards, etc. No. We want to discuss and deliberate because these decisions are much more consequential than admitting an undergraduate student. Finally, why is it that in the criminal justice system, the most important question, whether someone is guilty or not, cannot be decided by actuarial methods? But whether to let the person out early, we may delegate the decision to an algorithm. In my first talk, I argued that in a clockwork universe, algorithmic predictions may be preferable, but we do not live in a clockwork universe. Time is real, it has direction, and the future always includes surprises, as it is not just the mechanical recombination of the past. We looked at natural phenomena and saw that even in the physical world, Laplace's demon would be stumped. In my second talk, I surveyed aggregate predictions of the social world. Here we had to grapple with a higher degree of complexity, yet predictions could be simplified to the extent to which we could assume away both the agency of the predicted, invoking the countless insignificant causes cancelling out principle, and declaring that individual intentions and actions cancel out. And we could also assume away the agency of the predictor, observing that the aggregates are just too large for the predictor to influence the outcome. In my last talk, I will focus on individual predictions. Here we will have to contend with issues that we did not when we predicted movements of planets or behavior of large populations, or at least not to the same extent, agency and power. So let's start with credit. In the world of credit, the difference between lending paltry sums to consumers and princely fortunes to corporations cannot be more different, but in a way that runs counter to Mayall's conclusion. The Consumer Credit Bureau Experian, extolling the virtues of actuarial judgment, explains why you must be put through their famous Fair Isaac and Company algorithm. Before credit scores, they write, lenders physically looked over each applicant's credit report to determine whether to grant credit. A lender might deny credit based on a subjective judgment that a consumer already held too much debt or had too many recent late payments. Not only was this time-consuming, but also human judgment was prone to mistakes and biases. Lenders use personal opinion to make a decision about an applicant that may have had little bearing on the applicant's ability to repay the debt. Credit scores help lenders assess risk more fairly because they are consistent and objective. Yet when it comes to real money, the story changes. This is how large corporations, corporate loans are judged according to Standard & Poor's, one of the big three rating agencies. Credit ratings are opinions about credit risk. Our ratings express our opinion about the ability and willingness of an issuer, such as corporation, state, or city government, to meet its financial obligations in full on time. Credit ratings can also speak to, notice the vagueness, the credit quality of an individual debt issue, such as a corporate or municipal bond, and the relative likelihood that the issue may default. Credit ratings are not absolute measure of default probability. Since there are future events and developments that cannot be foreseen, the assignment of credit ratings is not an exact science. All hinges on whether the future and the past are radically different. While Standard & Poor's stresses that the future is full of unforeseen events, Fair Isaac, the supplier of the consumer scores, writes on its website, predictive models analyze past performance to predict how likely a consumer is to exhibit a specific behavior in the future. But notice, there's a tiny quotation mark around predict. In any case, it seems like consumers are judged on Newton time, corporation on Berkshire. To understand what is wrong with credit scores, we must see how they are created. Predicted algorithms connect an outcome at time t minus 1 with a set of input variables at t minus 2 with a mathematical function that we will call the link function. The link function is a statistical model, as opposed to in machine learning, assigns weights to the input variables in a way that when we combine them, the weighted sum will best predict the outcome. The weights we can interpret as the net effect of the input variable. This is how FICO is currently calculated, but probably not for long. Notice that these models are predicting the more recent past from the distant past. We have no data from the future. The prediction then happens, the real prediction then happens, when the new applicant's input scores from the present t are plugged into our equation, and using the calculated weights, we predict her outcome in the future t plus 2. So we assume that the distant past predicts the recent past, and the same mechanism will work for present data to predict the future. Suppose you are still skeptical about Bergson's time and side with Newton. Or just say that if the time scale is short enough, Newton's time is good enough approximation, things may change a lot in the long run, but not next month. You still face the following dilemma. Which link function to use? One answer is to build a theoretical argument up front for, say, a logistic regression or discriminant analysis, carefully translating the mathematical assumptions of the algorithm to the problem at hand. However, this is not always possible. Another answer is to see which model predicts most precisely, which function predicts best. We will want to understand how the model creates our prediction, but only after discovering which link function works. Unfortunately, there is no super function that we can go to that will always give us the best prediction if we still want intelligible results. In one case, the best intelligible model will be logistic regression. In another, it will be probit models. Yet, in another, recursive partitioning algorithm. Even if two functions predict the same number of cases correctly, those may not be the same cases. Using multiple functions will not help either. We can't be certain that the cases that all models agree on are correctly predicted. Moreover, each prediction will have some error. Those will be of two types: false positives, people who look good on the model, to the model, but are bad in reality, and false negatives, good prospects classified as risky. Banks that want to minimize losses may opt for a model that minimizes false positives and choose models that fits worse overall by racking up many false negatives. The bank may be happy, but if you are a good borrower and denied the loan, you will be hurt by the choice of the link function. However, here, one can still tell a story. The model gives special weight to the number of loans you already have or your income, and that is because people with more loans and less income are more likely to default. With machine learning, you will likely predict better, although Salganik's Fragile Families Challenge gave little evidence of that, but at the cost of intelligibility. Intelligibility is a problem of agency. If the predicted does not understand why they are put into a certain category, why they are denied a loan in this case, there is not much they can do to change that. Their agency is taken away. This is especially dangerous since consumer lending prices loans according to risk calculated from the past, giving worse customers worse loans and better customers better loans. And that produces a self-fulfilling prophecy. Taking away agency to break out of a downward spiral is hard if one cannot find out how to improve. But the predictor also loses agency. For the prediction algorithm to work, it must be very specific about the outcome. Suppose the prediction is about default. Lenders also care about other things like profitability, market share, getting information about prospective clients, and avoiding legal troubles. Those who do not pay their loans on time can still be very profitable. Sometimes growing your customer base is worth it, even if you sweep up many bad clients. To know who is a good client, you need to some bad clients for comparison, and having a system that you cannot reason about will open you up to legal challenges by those adversely affected. When these other objectives become more important, lenders abandon or override the decision of the algorithm. The reason why banks use algorithms for consumer lending is because it is cheap and fast. It is a cheap and fast way to make a rough guess on a large scale. Importantly, the cost of error is entirely borne by the customers, the good ones who pay for the deadbeats. The algorithm gives lenders a legitimacy and legal protection. Their agency is not curtailed because they can suspend it whenever it suits them, or just simply change the relation between the score the algorithm creates and their loan decision. They choose a different cutoff point, or they decide to assign different conditions to different points. At the same time, the algorithm they use remains a proprietary secret, limiting the agency of their clients which, of course, lenders prefer. Algorithm is an instrument of power. Corporate lenders are in a different situation. Here, a rough guess is not enough. Losses cannot be easily shifted to other clients. More importantly, the borrower here has more agency. As the famous saying goes, if you borrow $10,000 from a bank, you have a problem. If you borrow $100 million, the bank does one. The bank does it. The bank has a problem. If the company borrows from a bank, it also can offer to buy other services. Their relationship is more interdependent. If it borrows from the financial markets and uses rating agencies, those agencies are paid by the company that is being rated. In college admissions, just as in credit decisions, one must evaluate the future performance of individuals and make a decision whether to grant them a service. Last week, the University of Chicago announced that it no longer will use standardized tests in its highly competitive admissions process. It admits about 8% of the people that apply. Instead, it will use a holistic approach where a committee will judge applicants on a wide set of criteria, including essays responding to quirky prompts like this one. The late New York Times photographer Bill Cunningham once said, "Fashion is the armor to survive the reality of everyday life. I don't think you could do away with it. It would be like doing away with civilization. Tell us about your armor." This is one prompt. Then you can see some others. U of Chicago is joining a long list of high-ranking colleges that have already replaced standardized tests, the ACT and the SAT, and algorithms with judgment. College admissions are one of Mayo's strong cases for algorithmic decision-making. So why do these colleges move towards clinical assessment? Just as the bank, colleges have multiple goals and algorithms are specific to only one of them, is not going to cut it. Universities also must navigate multiple objectives. They want to get students with the greatest academic promise, but they also want to promote social mobility, diversity. They want students who fit well with what the university can offer and students who can contribute to the campus community. Even if the standard tests could help them meet one of the objectives, they may be useless or even counterproductive on others. Standard scores do predict academic performance in college, but surprisingly poorly. So here you can see, this is data from UCSD, scores, the strongest correlation is SAT2, it's 0.4. And when you take everything together, everything that we know about the applicant, and you know, we have like thousands of applicants, the best we can do is we can predict the end of first year GPA at UCSD with an R-squared of 27.27. So 27% of the variation is explained by everything that we know of the grades, the grade point average by the end of the year, which of course becomes even more, this relationship between initial scores becomes more attenuated as they move along and get to the second and third year. So we are not predicting very much, and with grades even less. So Chicago also pointed out that using standard scores directs the agency of the students in the wrong direction. Students spend a lot of time and money on test preparation courses, learning skills of taking multiple choice tests, but not knowledge and thinking. The price of these courses puts poor students at a disadvantage and blocks social mobility. Predicting future promise using standardized tests will reproduce past inequalities. So let's look at crime. In the 2002 Steven Spielberg movie, The Minority Report, John Anderton, played by Tom Cruise, is the chief of pre-crime, a police unit whose job is to prevent crime before it happens. Set in 2054, Anderton is aided by three precogs, mutated humans, who pre-visualize crimes in their sleep, hours before they happen. The brain is wired to a computer, and Anderton's job is to figure out from the clues where the next crime is going to take place, swoop in, and stop it before it happens. People get arrested when they are just about to commit their heinous act. The pre-crime unit in the city of Chicago does not depend on mutant brains. It relies on a computer-generated hot list of likely perpetrators. The strategic subject list consists of over 400 people predicted to be at the highest risk of being involved in gun-related violence. The algorithm considers not just one's criminal history, but also his ties to other criminals. 90%, 95% are men on this list. This is defined, the ties to other criminals, is defined as ego being arrested with alter. The ties that enter the model are first degree and second degree ties. The second degree ties are ties to people your co-arrestee was arrested with at another occasion. The original intent was to use this list to put criminals on notice, detain or arrest for minor violations, but also to offer them help. The help part never materialized. The list showed little predictive accuracy. But one has to keep in mind that had the list worked perfectly, its predictions would have been overturned by the actions of the Chicago police. Prediction in the service of prevention, if successful, always produces a self-frustrating prophecy. The policy question is whether the hot list decreased gun-related crime or not. It did not. In fact, there was an uptick of crime related to violence after its introduction, a point that played well for Donald Trump in his election campaign, as Chicago is run by Democrats. What the list was useful for was to round up suspects after the fact. It served as a list of the usual suspects, or an inferior most wanted list. Yet predictive policing is spreading. By the way, about 300 or 400 gun-related crimes that year, 1% was committed by people who were on this list. Three people. Yet predictive policing is spreading, and not just to U.S. cities like Los Angeles and Kansas City, but you might be interested to find out, it is now piloted in Germany, in Karlsruhe and Stuttgart, focusing on burglaries. The Chicago algorithm is based on a social theory of crime that emphasizes the role of social factors. Crime comes from peer pressure. The German model is based on learning theory, using an earthquake analogy, which is very appropriate because there was just an earthquake in Osaka, the place where I'm going to arrive tomorrow. And we have learned last time, and I think first lecture, that the only earthquake we can forecast is the one that happens after the earthquake happened. So the aftershock is the only one that we can forecast. And this is exactly the analogy that this theory is using. So, as aftershocks follow quakes fairly predictably, burglars return to the same areas to rob because they invested in learning about the neighborhood and want to use their knowledge. These are causal narratives that explain the prediction. because the algorithm producing Chicago's list is a meaningful one, we do see its flaws and strengths. One of its flaws is that it makes you responsible for the people you associate with and the people with whom your associates keep company. This is unfair, but this may actually reduce crime, giving an incentive for people to shun criminal characters. The German model may force criminals to spread their burglaries over larger territory, which may make them more prone to mistakes leading to their apprehension. Algorithms are never used in court deciding guilt. But some model shows that the accused had a 94.5% probability of having committed the crime is not an argument allowed in trial. But algorithms are used elsewhere in the criminal justice process at setting bail, sentencing, and parole. This is often referred to as evidence-based decision-making. Parole boards often rely on the algorithm level service inventory revised, here it is, LSIR, to decide on early release. It has 54 items and includes 10 subscales. Some are within, others outside the convict's control. The ones the convict can change are giving them agency. Parole boards, too, must consider multiple goals. They are not using this mechanically, because they have also multiple goals beyond predicting recidivism. They worry about the cost of keeping the prisoner in prison, maintaining prison discipline, reducing overcrowding, giving incentives for rehabilitation, racial justice, and sentence equalizing, that is, keeping to the same crime, same punishment principle. Here you can actually see how well inventory is predicting recidivism. Again, not very well. You can see that the strongest correlations are somewhere under 0.3. So, what are some of the lessons that we learned from credit, college admission, and criminal justice? These allow us to articulate why we should be skeptical about algorithmic predictions. Algorithms in all three situations are instruments of action. They are not simply bets on things beyond our control. In fact, the very reason for making predictions is to intervene. There is agency on both sides of these predictions. The predictor, lender, college, criminal justice system, have multiple objectives to be successful. Prediction works best when the outcome is forecast, when the outcome it forecasts is very specific. The predicted borrower, student applicant, suspect, and criminal also try to turn the prediction to their own advantage. Borrowers try to improve their FICO scores and occasionally game the system. College students prep for the standardized test and learn the tricks of test taking. Criminals avoid being arrested with other criminals not to get on the list, on the strategic list, or improve their behavior in prison to get a good score on the LSIR. While algorithmic predictions of the credit score and the LSIR could be preferable to the clinical predictions of biased loan officers or prejudiced judges, they also generate historical inertia and rigidity as they are mechanical projections of the past onto the future. Unless there is active intervention by the predictor and or the predicted or a third party, its main effect will be to perpetuate past patterns and trap people and groups in divergent trajectories, making poor poorer, the rich richer, children of less educated flunk and of the better educated get into Princeton, kids from crime-infested neighborhoods go to jail, and from affluent neighborhoods avoid the criminal justice system altogether. While this is happening, the predictive power of the model is increasing because it acts as a self-fulfilling prophecy. The polarization goes on until the system becomes unsustainable. In a world where only the well-off get a mortgage, only the educated can send their kids to college, and only people who can avoid in their youth to be ever booked by the police can stay and can stay out of the criminal justice system, political tensions will eventually boil over. So why did Mail and company find that algorithms are always better predictors than people? It is because the experimental situation is tailor-made for algorithms. Outcomes must be well-defined, unambiguous, and singular. Predictions are a one-shot game where at one time the expert and the algorithm predict, and at another there is an outcome to be evaluated. In those experiments, there are no self-fulfilling or self-frustrating prophecy effects, as neither the predictor nor the predicted have any agency and can interfere with the outcome. All of these factors would have confounded the experiments and would have incurred criticism from journal reviewers. To put it differently, Mal sacrificed external validity for internal validity. Algorithmic governance means the replacement of social institutions and processes with algorithmic decision-making. There are areas where this should be welcomed. The algorithmic coordination of traffic lights surely beats the policeman standing at the intersection with batons directing traffic. Internet banking is an improvement over standing in line at the bank. When the process is well targeted and low stakes, we are usually happy to hand it over to algorithms if they do their jobs. But now we are entering a world where algorithms are taking over in high stakes and wide areas. In the U.S., we see a market-led solution. Credit scores designed to predict loan payments are now used off-label for other purposes, widening their use. Job applications often require submitting credit scores. Car insurance premiums are calculated on the basis of these numbers, and landlords demand to see them to decide whether to rent and with what conditions. Credit scores are now predicting if you will be a good employee, a safe driver, or a good tenant. One result of this general use of one's credit score is that error in the score, and this is common because the underlying data is error-prone, will have vast consequences. Another more important consequence is that by linking various predictions, a bad score will lead not just to worse loans, but to failing to get a job and being charged higher insurance premium, which in turn will lead to a vortex of more credit trouble, lower scores, and so on. There is a second process in the market. Here, not the use, but the base of the score is widened. Traditionally, FICO scores are derived strictly from credit records and credit behavior. Credit companies are now widening the scope of the predictors as they purchase other companies that have accumulated data, other kind of data. Equifax, for instance, purchased a payroll outsourcing company, getting hold of over 150 million employee records. They also bought other companies collecting tax and wealth data. Now the credit score is calculated on a broader base, creating new opportunities for self-reinforcing processes. You lose your job, your score goes down just when you lost your income and may need a loan. The credit score itself creates a polarizing up and down spiral, but the widening use and the widening base make this much worse. The statist version of algorithmic governance is pioneered in China. In 2002, as China was entering the WTO, the government launched its own payment card, UnionPay. The card that 16 years later became the largest brand in the world, surpassing Visa and MasterCard, from the outset was not just a way to replace cash, but also to gather data on economic transactions. And the government soon began to build a nationwide credit registry and payment database, both to assess creditworthiness and to fight crime and corruption by, for instance, identifying tax evasion through linking tax and spending records. Since 2014, the state is overseeing the construction of the National Social Credit System, which takes an even more expansive view of individual creditworthiness, defining it as personal credibility, honesty, or character. Payment information is complemented by data on legal compliance and violations, and by social and moral history. While many of the details are still unclear, the social credit system is supposed to be a tool to increase sincerity in government by keeping tabs on the behavior of civil servants, in commercial relations by improving honesty in commercial credit and social relations by making people more virtuous in a wide variety of areas, from healthcare, birth control, and hygiene to energy saving and online behavior. Last but not least, the system is intended to record judicial probity to advance integrity in legal and criminal matters. While the new social credit system is scheduled for launch in 2020, currently two pilot projects are testing the waters. One is called Sesame Jima Credit by Ant Financial, formerly Alipay, a subsidiary of the giant online merchant Alibaba, and was licensed by the central bank in 2015. As payment is migrating from cards to cell phones, it works by taking over your smartphone, vacuuming up all information from what you buy to chats and emails. Its algorithm includes five broad categories: payment history, behavior, some quite as specific like hours of video games you play and the kinds of things you buy, ability to pay, such as money in your bank account and your education, connections, the score of your friends, and other characteristics like age, place of residence, etc. The data are processed into a single number from 300 to 950, modeled after the US FICO score. High scores result in perks, including no deposit car rental, over 650 points, and fast-track visa service to foreign countries, over 750. Actually, Luxembourg is one of the places where you can get quickly if you have more than 750 points. A low credit score can result not just in denial of a loan, but can exclude people from air travel and the use of high-speed trains. Sesame Credit currently has over 200 million users who voluntarily opted into this service. At the same time, municipalities are setting up their own scoring system for general behavior. Points are gained or lost for unpaid court fees, jaywalking, and even for neglecting one's elderly parent. The plan is to integrate these systems into the government's social credit database that will also add official files at various government agencies and data from surveillance cameras in public places analyzed with face recognition software. Prediction is being transformed into a pervasive system of surveillance and control. The system is supposed to predict trustworthy behavior, but it is unclear how that is measured or how that will be measured. So far, what we see is that certain violations become the focus of the system. For Sesame Credit, it started with loan payment behavior. Yet a lot of people just don't borrow, so Jima, Sesame Credit, was allowed to include the blacklist of people who failed to pay court fees and judgments. Those people saw their credit score adjusted downwards. It is important to see that this has nothing to do with predictions anymore. The adjustment is not done according to some predictive algorithm that would show how much more likely people not paying legal fees and fines are likely to default on their loans, for instance. The algorithm, which is secret, simply deducts points determined by some people at Sesame Credit. The same is true for the municipal initiatives. There, the algorithm is based on the moral intuition of local officials. However, once these scores are created for a group of citizens, an algorithm can predict that for those who don't have it, and or use them on the input side to forecast a different outcome. This then runs up against a fundamental problem. If the entire point of scoring is to change behavior, machine learning will not work well because the authorities won't be able to communicate what the citizen must do to improve their scores. But there is an opposite danger. Transparency gives citizens agency not just to mend their ways, but to mend their scores without necessarily mending their ways to game the system. Currently, Sesame Credit is very popular in China because it is a measure of transparency and predictability that many felt was missing. During the last decades of rapid social change, China was flooded with pianzi, swindlers. Social institutions did not protect well people from fraud, and algorithms, to some extent, do. So, to give you some sort of a conclusion after three talks. This is my best shot. Prediction is inevitable part inevitable part of social life. It is ironic that technology we design to make our world more predictable locally makes our world less predictable globally. The technology that assumes a world run on Newton's and Einstein's directionless time, where the future is without true novelty, actually makes Bergson's point that the future is full of surprises much more plain to see. Prediction is very difficult, especially if it's about the future. Predictions are easiest in the natural world of inanimate objects, although even there they are not easy to make, as we encounter limitations such as entropy, chaos, and ontological uncertainty. Predictions are harder once people are involved. Here the trick is to eliminate the agency of people, forming the aggregate by assuming their agency cancels out. It is also necessary to eliminate the agency of the prediction by assuming that the aggregate is too large to be influenced by our forecast. Predictions are even more complex when it comes to people. Here agency is paramount. The strongest predictions are self-fulfilling prophecies. Those are easier to achieve when the agency of the predicted is limited. Algorithms curtail our agency by removing prediction from human discourse. Self-fulfilling prophecies can lead to social polarization as they reinforce and amplify past inequalities. That the future is open may be exciting to some, but clearly makes many of us very anxious. Thank you.